Hello, my name is Ben Burrell, and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Thank you to everyone that has supported the podcast in the last week. Hello to Jimmy, that's Jim Myers. Hi to Alex Ellison and Scott Leslie and Michelle Sussex as well. You can support the podcast by buying me a coffee. There's a link in this episode's description. Literally, at the moment, I think I have a caffeine dependency going on. So fuel that, please. It literally is fuel in the podcast. As I say, there's a link in the episode description. And there's also a link to my PayPal me if you prefer that too. And I know it's boring that I keep saying this, but it really does help the podcast. If you can, rate and review the show. That would really, really help us out. Give us 5 stars, write a little review, and thank you for doing that in advance. So today's episode is all about an album that changed things not only for Bob, but for music, and is just still an incredible listen despite its age. This is 1965's Highway 61 Revisited.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on.
Very few albums are as important as this one to Dylan's career. It marked a critical high, it was a huge shift in sound, and it pretty much changed rock and roll forever. It could be seen as the perfect album. It really does tick all the boxes. The record, in many ways, begins on the 10th of May 1965. Dylan had just finished his second night at the Royal Albert Hall in London, the final show in a brief tour of England. It was a tour that was physically and mentally exhausting for Bob, something that is infamously chronicled in the documentary Don't Look Back. I was playing a lot of songs I didn't want to play, he's quoted as saying. It's very tiring having other people tell you how much they dig you if you yourself don't dig you. This would come to a head 2 months later at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival, where he'd famously go electric.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
What was started with Bringing It All Back Home would be continued here. That electric sound almost becomes more and more prominent with every track. While that previous record had a respectful nod to Dylan's past loved persona, this is the first record that doesn't feature just him solo on the guitar anywhere. Even when it appears to, it doesn't. The closest we come is album closer, Desolation Row, which actually features Nashville-based guitarist Charlie McCoy bringing some truly special feels to the song. For the most part, though, the album is Bob and the band. He's the rock frontman. He even started dressing like one. Ray-Bans and leather jackets were a big part of his look around this time, a marked change from his previous life. And speaking of life, his personal life at this point was complicated. While he brought Joan Baez on the UK tour with him, he was already living at the Chelsea Hotel with Sarah, who he'd marry in a secret ceremony in November 1965. Adding to this chaos was Dylan's amphetamine use. Singer and actress Marianne Faithfull is quoted as saying, "They were all so fucking high." She recalls Bob's suites at London Savoy Hotel that included Donovan and Allen Ginsberg. She says, "Every 5 minutes or so, someone would go to the bathroom and come out speaking in tongues." So it would appear it was rock and roll on and off tape for this album. And that fog of amphetamine is something that is draped over all three of these classic albums in this era. It starts with Johnny mixing up the medicine on Subterranean Homesick Blues. It continues here with offbeat images like the ones found in Tombstone Blues and goes right through to Blonde on Blonde's Just Like a Woman.
Her amphetamine and her pearls.
And all of this makes up the backdrop to the album. It is a chaotic record. The atmosphere is one that is blurred round the edges. The vibe is somewhere between hungover and exhaustion. Obviously, that drug use powers that, but also Dylan's touring schedule and the pushback over him going electric adds considerable weight as well. This also informs the major themes of the record. By the album's recording sessions, he joined the ranks of the rich and famous, and by the sounds of it, Dylan didn't like what he saw. It pushed Bob to exhaustion. He ends up resenting this world of high society, which is something that is all over this album. Dylan, as he's done many times in his career, is challenging authority and status at every turn. Whether it's Tombstone Blues' disparaging lyrics about the Commander-in-Chief, supposedly Lyndon B. Johnson,
the Commander-in-Chief answers him while chasing a fly.
Or here on album closer, Desolation Row.
Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance.
Or Bob's scathing attack on a hapless member of the bourgeoisie who's constantly asking him questions and analysing his songs. which is a little bit awkward given this podcast.
You try so hard, but you don't understand.
Or even here with a direct address.
Now all the authorities, they just stand around and boast.
And of course, not forgetting Queen Jane's story of imprisoned decadence.
Now with all the clowns that you have commissioned.
Also, there's multiple references to fairy tale characters, but they all seem to be in a bit of a state, giving us the impression that this journey to the rich and famous has been like a fairy tale existence, only for it to be revealed as a mirage. Bob clearly has an axe to grind, something that is never more present than on the classic album opener, Like a Rolling Stone. Over an exhausting, thrilling hurricane 6 minutes, Bob tells us the classic tale of a fall from grace. The protagonist starts out life as a member of the elite, but it quickly unravels.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
Those famous opening words still sound so fresh today, as Bob outlines the whole story pretty much in four lines and two rhymes. He sings, "Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bums of dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say beware dull, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you." Notes that fairy tale opener of Once Upon a Time. The rhyming structure here isn't unheard of, but the slightly off-kilter pattern is more ambitious than a normal rhyming couplet. On the first line, Bob rhymes time on the fifth syllable with the word fine 4 syllables later. The same thing happens in the next line with the word dime landing on the fifth syllable. However, the next rhyming word is prime, which is 3 syllables later, not 4. This creates a little bit of extra space, and instead of throwing it away with an ooh or a yeah, Bob brings a potency to the whole stanza as he sings didn't you. He even manages to squeeze 3 syllables of didn't you into 2 syllables as he sings didn't you, which weirdly doesn't sound out of place or wrong. That extra space, though, that is created by a word landing a syllable earlier does so much. It highlights the words didn't you, and that's really important to this song. It not only brings an aggression to the previous line, it's now like an interrogation, but because it doesn't rhyme with anything else either, it stands out more, highlighting itself even further. Those, once again, nursery rhyme rhymes of time, fine, dime and prime are easy childlike rhymes, but they're abruptly broken up by that didn't you.
Do the bumps of dime in your prime, then you.
It's a similar story on the song's bridges, as Bob sings, "You said you'd never compromise with the mystery tramp, but now you realise he's not selling any alibis," as you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and ask him, "Do you want to make a deal?"
You say you never compromise with the mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling any alibis, as you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, "Do you want to make a deal?"
We'll just pause the song there for a second, and you'll notice how jarring it is to pause the song at that point, and that's because we're at a crucial part. This has been set up wonderfully by the lyrics. Compromise, realise, alibis and eyes all make up the rhyming scheme here, before make a deal becomes the standout non-rhyming line. Here, though, it's for a different reason than the one on the verse. It doesn't add some bite, but it does set us up for the chorus line. Just like a joke, it primes us ready for the punchline, which Bob delivers over a rush of guitars, the organ and drums as he completes the rhyme with "How does it feel?"
Make a deal. How does it feel? How does it feel?
And then on that chorus, we're almost rewarded with those rhymes of own, home, unknown and then stone. Interestingly, we get no standout non-rhyming line at the very end. It's very final. It's like Bob has delivered his judgment. There's nothing more to say after that.
No. Like a rolling stone.
lyrical meaning of this song has been pored over a million times, with their meanings twisted and moulded to fit whatever narrative is of interest. It's obviously a story of that fall from grace I mentioned before. The first verse sets that up perfectly with those lyrics about being rich and throwing bums a dime. Before then, in the next lines, we hear a warning of beware, doll, you're bound to fall, which becomes true as early on as the first bridge, as Bob sings, "Now you don't talk so loud, now you don't seem so proud." The chorus then basks in this mess as Bob almost rejoices in this person's sorry situation, adding to that idea of ridiculing high society. By the time we're on to the next two verses, it's a sorry picture. Bob sings, "Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're going to have to get used to it."
Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're going to have to get used to it.
So now our subject is out on the streets and she's down on her luck. The next verses are really interesting. At first, Bob blames the subject of the song for getting herself into this situation with the aforementioned line, "You never turned around to see the frowns on the jugglers and the clowns when they all did tricks for you," saying she is the one that should have noticed the pitfalls in her world. But then he goes on to bemoan the situation that she is in as he sings, "You used to ride on the chrome horse with your diplomat who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at after he took from you everything he could steal?" It's as if Bob is saying that while she is to blame for this downward spiral, there's external forces that aren't helping either. The elite classes have now disowned our protagonist. She is not flavour of the month anymore. Her time is sadly done. They've taken everything from her they could steal. Desperation then seeps in as she has to pawn her diamond ring just to get by. Dylan, reflecting on her downfall, sings about Napoleon in rags. The lines are, "You used to be so amused at Napoleon in rags and the language that he used. Go to him now, he calls you, you can't refuse. When you ain't got nothing, you've got nothing to lose. You're invisible now, you've got no secrets to conceal.
Exchanging all precious gifts, but you better take your diamond ring. You better pawn it, babe.
Napoleon in rags here seems to represent the fakery of the elite classes, a pretentious individual who is trying to represent himself as a man of the people in rags, using language to impress when in fact he's someone completely different. But who exactly is he? Well, there's a long-held thought that this is a reference to Andy Warhol, and it might well be. This idea of a woman in high society that crashes upon hard times is almost mirrored in socialite Edie Sedgwick's story. Sedgwick, who featured in several Andy Warhol films, including the 1965 movie Poor Little Rich Girl, very apt for this song, was born an heiress but lived the bohemian life. She was a mainstay in Warhol's factory scene. He even dubbed her his first superstar. By 1965, though, their relationship had deteriorated somewhat. Following her estrangement from Warhol's inner circle, she began living at the Chelsea Hotel, apparently becoming close to Dylan. She even signed up with Albert Grossman, Dylan's manager. The story goes that she and Bob began some sort of relationship, which ultimately ended before it really began. As I've already mentioned, Bob would go on to marry his first wife, Sarah, in November 65. Ultimately, Sedgwick would die at just 28 due to acute barbiturate intoxication, and since her death there's been all sorts of rumours about her, even one about her possibly conceiving a baby with Dylan, although this does seem quite unlikely. There's quite a bit of evidence to suggest she was treated poorly by Warhol and did suffer some difficult personal issues too, but as always with personal stories, it's quite hard to separate fact from fiction. What we do know, though, is Bob did know her, but claims not to have had an intimate relationship with her. It would appear she developed a crush on Bob, with a number of quotes saying that she thought they'd star in a film together before cruelly, at a chance meeting in a restaurant, Warhol told her Bob had just married. Away from that, there is traces of Sedgwick's story in this song, and possibly other Dylan compositions too. Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat and Just Like a Woman from Blonde on Blonde appear to reference her, or at least certainly someone that appears to be living a similar life to her, someone like Sedgwick, a socialite wrapped up in the scene, doomed from the very start. There's also a case to say She's Your Lover Now, an outtake from Blonde on Blonde, might be about Bob, Edie, and the folk singer Bob Newirth. But here lies the problem. It would actually appear that Edie was more involved with New Earth. She's quoted as saying in Chow Manhattan, "It was really sad, me and Bobby's, not Dylan, and my affair. It's the only true, passionate and long-lasting love scene I've ever had." While it does make a good story that this song is about Sedgwick, it really doesn't feel like she's one of Dylan's great loves. And with this, it's hard to believe he wrote all those songs just about her, especially this 6-minute epic. Having said that, their scenes did cross over. She would have been on his mind, and they were both in the same boat. They were both famous, but still outsiders. She from the establishment now in this creative scene, and he from the other end thrust into it too. So it's quite possible that parts of her ended up in his songs. That verse I mentioned before of "you used to ride on the chrome horse with your diplomat who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat, ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at" could very well be about the whole situation. Literally, one of Warhol's works is called Siamese Cat, and it's fair to say he did take a lot from Sedgwick, which kind of fits in with the lines directly after that about taking everything he could steal. So the lines do fit to a degree. Warhol himself even weighed in on the debate in an interview with Popism, as he says, "I liked Dylan. He created a brilliant new style. I even gave him one of my silver Elvis paintings in the days when he first came around. Later on, though, I got paranoid when I heard rumours that he used the Elvis as a dartboard up in the country. When I'd ask people why did he do that, they'd say, 'He feels like you destroyed Edie.' Or listen to like a Rolling Stone, 'You're the diplomat on the chrome horse.' He blamed me for Edie's drugs." And while Edie's story is close to the one being told in Like a Rolling Stone, for me, this song is more than that. Like I mentioned when we looked at Positively 4th Street, this song feels bigger than just a story about one person that Dylan knew. This is a saga. Just like at the root of many works of fiction, there's a classic story being retold here. In Star Wars, for example, there's the fundamental struggle between good and evil. In, say, Finding Nemo, for example, there's the idea of if you love something, let it go. Your children have got to make their own mistakes. Here, it's all about human downfall. Just like with Macbeth's corruption, this is a tale of a person falling apart, not just one situation in 60s New York. Away from those lyrics, the sonics of the song are thankfully world-beating and more than match up to the words. This is a huge, gleaming rock song with a big pop hook, an era-defining riff, and a bridge that whips us up into a frenzy before them both. It starts with, as Springsteen famously described it, that snare shot that sounds like somebody kicked open a door to your mind. It sounds like a gunshot starting the race. It kicks everything into motion. The guitar, bass, organ, and piano all launch into a whirlwind of sound. That piano has an almost honky-tonk feel about it, like it's being played in a bar in an old western. The guitar is the opposite, it's quite modern sounding, it's rock and roll. Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Whilst the organ is the one thing that ties it all together. What I like is how the piano and the organ slightly dip in the mix as Bob flies into those opening lines. Crucially, his delivery isn't OTT. He lets the words handle that. This is a cold and unforgiving delivery with a sneer, but it's not a pantomime sneer. He really means it. Laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. In classic Bob style, the recording is a little off as the vocal jumps to one ear momentarily. It's very Dylan to have the imperfect perfect song. People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. The percussion, though, is the unsung hero of the piece. Not only does it fire the starting gun, but it also adds bite to the song throughout. That tambourine, which inhabits the right ear, throws just the right amount of pace to the record. And it also adds a bit of edge, too, to the actually quite conservative guitars. Bobby Gregg on drums and Bruce Langhorne on tambourine shouldn't be underestimated here. At the start of the song, Gregg plays the larger ride cymbal and side stick, hitting the side of a snare drum to create that shallower, more wooden sound. Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you... Which sounds a little bit like this. By the time we're 3/4 of the way through, though, a more fuller sound of the snare drum is present, along with some bigger fills that gives the track a swelling quality. It builds to a stadium rock status. You better pawn it, babe. You used to be. Which sounds something like this. So amused. The track occasionally goes out of time too. This is why, for me, it's also a punk tune. I think it's fair to say this is a prelude to punk. Dylan's sneer at high society and their actions sounds like it would have been a jumping-off point for Johnny Rotten. There's an us-versus-them theme that isn't too present anywhere else in music at the time. Dylan helps to pave the way for a movement that wouldn't materialise until the next decade. The song itself is the final track to be produced by Tom Wilson, who'd worked on the previous trio of records with Bob. We'll touch on possibly why he left on a future episode, but he leaves us with some great production. And whilst I mention this is a big rock song in almost every form, it's a pop song too. We have a riff, a bridge, and a huge, huge chorus. It's a pop song format. Despite being over 6 minutes long, which was different from 99% of the other pop songs at the time, it follows a well-trodden, almost formulaic path. It starts with those organ and piano riffs which give way to the verse's vocals, building to that bridge of You Used to Laugh About with its descending melody, something we've seen time and time again on this podcast series. It then climaxes with the next line, Your Next Meal, and that elongated L of meal sets us up for the chorus, like the whole preceding minute has been us running up to the edge of the cliff and now we're jumping off. In a very pop song style, those riffs from before return to the chorus, bringing symmetry to the whole thing. The brilliance of the Sonics is you never feel there's really any let-up. It just keeps going and going and going, getting bigger and bigger. It's like a runaway train. Every second that passes, the thing gets more out of hand. 3 minutes in, and things are starting to get into a frenzy.
Ah, you never turned around to see the frowns on the jugglers and the clowns when they all did tricks for you.
That slight mic popping on Tricks For You adds again to that punky sound, and the mic is pushed to the limit with Bob's final words. It never distorts, but we get pretty close.
With no direction, ho! Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone.
That harmonica at the end is one final battle cry from Dylan, like he's run out of words, but he's still not done. However, it's the organ that is the star of the show. Its riff is in the lead role when Dylan's not on stage. It's placed unusually high in the mix and, strangely, has a slightly delayed sound. It's just a little bit behind everything else here. Was this a conscious decision to add a little bit of spontaneity to the tune? Well, not quite. It's become one of those great musical pieces of folklore, which perhaps isn't the best phrase to use here, considering Dylan has just turned his back on folk, but the story goes something like this. Dylan had played a rough, slow version of the song for the band, which you can hear on the first volume of the bootleg series.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? Why can't we get that right?
This wasn't quite coming together, so the next day they regrouped and Tom Wilson invited musician Al Cooper to the session. He says in the book Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, I walked into the studio with my guitar case, unpacked, tuned up and plugged in, and sat there trying my hardest to look like I belonged. Soon enough, usual guitarist Mike Bloomfield walked in and began practicing. Cooper says he started to play some of the most incredible guitar I'd ever heard, and he was just warming up. I was way in over my head. I embarrassingly unplugged, packed up, and just went back to the control room. With Cooper there, he watched the band tear through the song. Paul Griffin, who plays the piano on the final version, had moved from the organ to the piano, leaving a space free. Cooper knew so little about the organ that he didn't even know how to turn it on, but he was desperate to play on a Dylan song, and when a distracted Wilson didn't give him a firm no, he walked into the studio and he did just that. Cooper writes, there was no music to read, the song was over 5 minutes long, the band was so loud I couldn't even hear what was going on with the organ, and I'm not familiar with the instrument to begin with, but I just gave it a go. The tape is rolling and that is Bob fucking Dylan over there, so this had better be me starting to play something. Unbelievably, Dylan dug Cooper's sound. He asked the organ to be turned up. Cooper says, you can hear how I waited until the chord was played by the rest of the band before committing myself to play it in the verses. He says, I'm always an eighth of a note behind everyone else, making sure of the chord before touching the key.
Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging.
This mistake would ironically give the song its signature sound, and also would give Cooper work with Dylan on Blonde on Blonde, Self Portrait, New Morning and the album Dylan in 1973. The resulting song was released on the 20th of July, just days before the Newport Folk Festival. Away from the hype and in the 21st century, how is the song shaping up? Well, pretty well, I'd suggest. For those hit singles that go down in history, there's two main ways to go. Either you etch yourself onto the public consciousness, like You're the One That I Want, or I'm a Believer, or even Baby One More Time, or you redefine the boundaries and stay at the top due to sheer innovation. I don't think we can call Like a Rolling Stone a mega hit. A hit single for sure, but number 2 on the Billboard Top 100 and number 4 in the UK isn't mega hit territory. But it survived because it did redefine things. A 6-minute single was so alien to things back in 65, so much so that his record company CBS tried to make the record more radio-friendly by cutting it in half and spreading it over two sides of vinyl. Both Dylan and his fans insisted the full duration of the recording be played on the radio, and they ultimately won. More than that, though, the song stands out due to its subject matter. That bedrock of contempt was the antithesis of every other song around it in the charts. Imagine listening to the radio back then and Like a Rolling Stone coming on.
It's not on you. Please release me.
Let's see it.
Now you don't seem so proud.
Like Elvis Costello is quoted as saying, it was a shocking thing to live in a world where Manfred Mann and the Supremes and Engelbert Humperdinck existed, and then comes Like a Rolling Stone. Today, the song remains a hugely important tune. It inspired so many, and we're not talking your average musicians, we're talking Hall of Famers here. Bruce Springsteen is quoted as saying, "The first time I heard Bob Dylan, I was in a car with my mother listening to WMCA, and on came that snare shot that sounded like somebody kicked open a door to your mind. The way that Elvis freed your body, Dylan freed your mind." Paul McCartney remembers going round to John Lennon's house in Weybridge to hear the song. According to McCartney, he said, "It seemed to go on forever. It was beautiful. He showed us it was all possible to go a little further." Frank Zappa also wanted to quit the music business after hearing the track because it did everything I wanted to do, he's quoted as saying. He basically is saying that Dylan completed music with the song. Not to mention it's been covered by a whole host of musicians and bands, from the Jimi Hendrix Experience to the Rolling Stones to Green Day to the Wailers and many, many more. Not only that, on the 24th of June 2014, in Sotheby's, they sold Dylan's original handwritten lyrics for the song for $2 million. $2 million. A record price for a popular music manuscript. Even Dylan himself told Ralph Gleason in 1966, "Like a Rolling Stone is the best song I've written," something he'd echo again in an interview in 2004. And I'm tempted to agree with him, although, somewhat predictably, my opinion on Dylan's best song changes almost hourly. Without this tune, though, who knows if we would have ever got other lengthy epics like Stairway to Heaven or Won't Get Fooled Again, or even punk in the way we got it. It was the first song that bared its teeth, says Bono. It showed McCartney and Lennon they could go a little further. It gave Springsteen license to write the similarly shattering Born to Run, and other musicians in genres on the periphery of the mainstream, like folk, to become bigger than their sound. Not only is this an incredible song, but it did incredible things. It also starts off a hugely significant album and encapsulates the record's main theme of criticising authority. But there's other themes going on the album too, most notably death. And that's something we look at next time. That is it for this first look at Highway 61 Revisited. I was sweating on this episode because it's quite hard to do such a great album, and particularly with Like a Rolling Stone, such a great song, justice. So I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know your thoughts on the episode, please. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast, and I'm on Twitter too at Ben Burrell. Come and say hello. Next time, we're looking at this wonderful album once again, so join me for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening and goodbye.